I'm Nick.
And I'm Em.
And welcome into the Ominous Archives. It's the start of spooky season.
It is. It's my favorite time of the year.
Yep.
It's the most wonderful time.
I feel like it's almost like everybody's favorite time of the year.
I just love fall. I love everything about it. I love spooky season. I love the pumpkin of it all. Mm-hmm. It's just my favorite time.
It is. It's just such a... The weather's perfect.
Mm-hmm. I also, not to get it twisted, I love Thanksgiving. I feel like Thanksgiving does not get enough appreciation in the capacity when we talk about fall. I think it's a great holiday. I love the food. The food's great.
Halloween gets like a whole month.
Right,
like,
exactly.
As soon as October 1 hits.
Everybody forgets about Thanksgiving.
There we go. And then Halloween ends.
Yes.
And then we go into November and it's just like, yeah, there's Thanksgiving.
Yeah, no. I love Thanksgiving so much.
Yeah. Who doesn't though?
I love all the fall.
Wawa brings back the gobbler.
You're not going to like what I have to say.
What?
I don't like the gobbler. But I don't like turkey.
I mean, that's a preference.
I don't like turkey. I don't like stuffing. And I really don't like cranberries.
So she loves Thanksgiving, but doesn't like any food that has to go with Thanksgiving.
Yeah, I feel like I did just contradict myself there. But like, our family's always made like food
for you.
Right. Like, we make ham for me because I eat the ham. But Frankie also appreciates the ham. So it's not just me.
That's because your mom makes a ridiculously good pineapple ham.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You're welcome, everyone.
Yep. I'm picky, so...
Yeah. Everybody else gets to enjoy it because I'm picky.
So, to start off spooky season, we should... Why not start with some, like, ghosts?
Of course.
That could be fun.
That could be fun. I feel like ghosts are the heart and soul of Halloween. Spooky season.
Totally.
I'm so excited. Okay. Just ghosts in general or just...
We'll find out.
Oh, okay. Let me not jump the gun here.
Yeah. We're heading into the heart of the Great White Way, the nickname for the Broadway Theater District in New York City.
Mm.
It was called the Great White Way because of the bright lights that were installed in the early 1900s. Did you?
I did know
I actually didn't.
Girl, I'm a theater girl. I'm a theater
also,
kid. Come on now.
Not a girl.
Listen, it's just be happy that I love you enough to call you girl.
Is that one of those things?
Yeah, it's one of my things. It's a thing for me.
A different kind of light also lingers. And this light's not for the living. It's for the restless. Now, a single ghost light burns center stage, guiding spirits as much as stagehands. This is Broadway After Dark, where the ghosts go on stage.
Love. Love, love, love.
Right? So, I actually had no idea about ghost lights. Just assumed it was a thing every time you see them in a show.
Yeah.
It's not. So, in nearly every theater, when the stage is dark and the audience is gone, one single light remains. It's called a ghost light.
Mm-hmm.
Now, traditionally, it's just a bare bulb fixed to a metal pole placed in the center of the stage. Once the house is empty... And at first glance, it seems like a simple tool, but the ghost light carries meaning far beyond its quiet glow. So, most obvious, why would you think there's a ghost light?
So, you can see?
Right. Safety. theaters are obviously full of hazards.
Yes.
There's the sudden drop of the edge of the stage, holes in the floor... Set pieces that get left behind, the rigging equipment. So without a light, anyone who enters legally, illegally, may find themselves in danger.
Very true.
One story often told to explain the tradition involves a burglar. According to legend, the man broke into a theater late at night, not realizing the house was completely dark. He fell into the orchestra pit and was injured. Some say he actually tried to sue the theater afterwards.
What?
And in response, ghost lights were installed as a basic precaution to keep it from happening again.
Hey, I broke into this theater and I hurt myself in the process, I'm going to sue you.
Oh, yeah.
Great, great thinking process. I wonder what those lawyers were thinking.
It's almost like nowadays you could sue anybody for anything.
This is true.
Yep. You looked at me sideways.
Yeah. I'm like, going to sue you.
Yep. And the sad thing is that people do it. So. Yeah.
Hey.
Wild.
People got to work. Lawyers need jobs.
So safety's only half of the story. Among many in the theater world, the ghost light is also tied to superstition. Some believes it keeps spirits from settling into the space. Others say it does the opposite. It helps appease the ghosts that are already there, giving them light so that they do not grow restless or cause trouble. I can't with him. Archie's currently... I don't even know if you can call that cuddling.
Relax.
He's just like mauling you. RG is, well, he's probably like a 60-pound golden retriever slash
anxiety.
Irish setter, and
okay?
He is trying to get all of him on M.
I think he would crawl on my skin if he could.
He probably would. Many performers and crew members will tell you that ghosts, much like people, do not like the dark. I wouldn't think that. Not
yeah,
at all.
Yeah, that's interesting, honestly.
I would have no, I would be like, one belief that is often shared, especially among longtime theater professionals, is that with a light on stage, the theater never fully closes. It remains open to memory, to energy, to whatever might linger from past performances. Which makes sense. I mean, I feel like you put so much emotion and time mm-hmm. into a show. So I could see that leaving like a echo.
Yeah.
I guess.
For sure.
Yeah. The ghosts in question are rarely described as malicious. More often, they are seen as echoes of actors who once performed there. Their attachment to the space is not one of anger, but of familiar. You're going to have to say that word.
Familiarity.
Thank you. I tried actually yesterday reading that, and I was like, I can't say this.
Honestly,
I kind of
struggled. Familiarity.
Familiarity.
There you go.
Familiarity.
Close
whatever.
Enough. They know what you're trying to say.
Oh, you know. It's familiar.
You get the point. It's familiar.
These are spaces where they lived out their craft, where they rehearsed, struggled, and succeeded. In the sense, the ghost light is not just a warning to the living, but a kind of gesture toward the past, a sign of respect, which I feel like a lot of theater people are. Mm-hmm. Like, they are very respectful or, I guess, even honored. Like, when, like, I feel like the cast of, like, with Wicked or whatever, when they would change, I feel like they're very honored to be like, I'm mm-hmm. proud to be stepping into this role
yep.
after showing, you know?
100%.
It's not just like, I'm better than you or
no,
whatever.
It's very much a respect thing mm-hmm. as well.
Like much of what happens in the theater, the ghost light balances practicality with tradition. It serves a real world purpose. It also carries meaning for those who work in these spaces day after day. And whether you believe in ghosts, you will find a ghost light in nearly every theater in New York and beyond. It is a tradition that continues. Not because it has to, but because enough people believe it should. Which is awesome. Because I also, again, like we were just talking about, like the respect and everything. The theater industry is so, I think they keep a lot of traditions or things like that, like alive. Mm-hmm. Because it's like, this is just what you should do.
Yeah.
Which is really, really cool. I have too many cups. I'm trying to.
Nick has three beverages.
I have three beverages currently. Three of them. So, why don't we just dive into the theaters? Enough about the theater, right?
Let's go.
We'll start with I think is probably the most famous one.
Hmm.
I feel like a lot of people know this story.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to head on over to the New Amsterdam Theater, which is located at 214 West 42nd Street. In New York.
New York.
So, for those of you who don't know, we're going to be talking about Olive Thomas, Broadway's Flapper Ghost. So the New Amsterdam Theater opened its doors on 42nd Street in 1903. It quickly became the home of the legendary Ziegfeld Follies, and within a decade, it helped launch the career of a young performer named Olive Thomas. She was born Olive R. Duffy. She arrived in New York at the age of 19 after separating from her first husband. How about that?
I was going to say, 19 and separating from her first husband?
Yep.
All right.
We just covered something else. Was it? Who? Oh, it was Lala Ray.
Mm-hmm.
She was 14.
Yeah, 14 is absolutely
crazy.
Insane.
Crazy. Archie's got his anxiety pickle. A year later, she won the title of Most Beautiful Girl in New York City, a contest that led to work as an artist's model. Her image grazed the cover. Grazed. Her image, it just grazed it.
just grazed.
You know, just touched it a little bit. Who is Shane Gillis?
Uh-huh.
Did you ever see his stunt?
Uh-huh.
Just grazed me a little bit.
Just grazed me a little bit.
Her image graced the covers of major publications like the Saturday Evening Post, and caught the eye of none other than Florence Ziegfeld. In 1915, she joined the Follies and later starred in the risque Midnight Frolic, where her popularity soared. She was gifted extravagant jewelry and became a well-known socialite. Eventually, she left for Hollywood, where she signed a film contract and secretly married actor Jack Pickford, brother of movie star Mary Pickford. Her film career was brief but successful. She starred in The Flapper in 1919, becoming the first actress to ever play such a role on screen, and helped introduce the term into pop culture. But her life and legend will be cut short just 1 year later.
Well, I can see why Miss Girl won the Most Beautiful Woman contest. She is very pretty.
Mm-hmm.
She's a very pretty girl.
In September of 1920, Olive Thomas and Jack Pickford were in Paris on what they called a second honeymoon, though most described it as a last attempt to repair their unraveling marriage. So they've been arguing for days, and on the night of September 5th, the couple went out drinking in the Montparnasse district. When they finally returned to their room at the Hotel Ritz, it was already past 3 a.m. Now, accounts of what happened next vary slightly, but the broad details remain constant. The night ended in a bitter, alcohol-fueled fight. According to some versions, Jack stormed out, leaving Olive alone and sobbing. What happened next remains a mystery, but the result is known. Olive grabbed a blue bottle of mercury bichloride, a toxic antiseptic prescribed to Jack to treat syphilis sores. The solution was meant to be applied topically, not ingested, and the capsules inside were reportedly shaped like tiny coffins.
Perfect.
A disturbing detail in that, in hindsight,
yeah,
seemed like a warning.
Very much so.
Big time. That would be wild. I mean, it's a, you know, it's report, what did they say?
Well,
they were reportedly shaped like tiny coffins. So.
Maybe, maybe not, but however,
it may or may not happen, but that's a
true detail. That
creepy,
is crazy.
Creepy detail. Whether it was confusion, desperation, or a tragic mistake, Olive drank the contents of the bottle. Jack later said he returned to the room and was awakened by her crying out, "Oh my God," as she was already in distress. Jack tried to get her to vomit and called for help. A doctor arrived and pumped her stomach 3 times. It wasn't enough. Olive Thomas died 5 days later on September 10th, 1920. Wild.
Yeah, that's insane.
To have your, like, her stomach pumped 3 times, mm-hmm. She probably got herself, like, they probably got her, like, they vomited, got her to vomit, and it still wasn't enough. Just, like,
yeah, that was, man. That stuff was not meant to be ingested.
So the death was ruled an accident, likely the result of misreading a French-labeled bottle in the moment of emotional collapse. But almost immediately, rumors began to circulate. Some claimed suicide, others whispered murder. And given the troubled state of her marriage and the volatile night that preceded her death, speculation is never fully quieted.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think it would. Mm. Unless he flat out would have came out and said something.
Right.
It won't. It'll never quiet. What is certain is that Olive Thomas was just 25 years old, a silent film star, a former Follies beauty, and one of Broadway's most promising talents. And she never came home. Some believe she never actually truly left. Now, not long after her death, Olive Thomas was seen again. Not on a film, not on stage, but in the empty halls of the New Amsterdam Theater. Stagehands began reporting sightings of a woman in a green, beaded Follies dress, often holding a blue bottle. She appeared on stage near the old roof garden. For years, the New Amsterdam sat in disrepair, but in the 1990s, Disney Theatrical signed a 99-year lease.
Dang.
And began restoring the theater.
99-year lease is crazy.
So it's at 2090?
Quick math.
No, 2089. Pretty sure it's 2089. Coming up.
Yeah.
Once they started restoring it, Olive returned. One night, during the renovation, a security guard on duty saw a woman standing on the stage in a green, beaded vintage Follies costume. He shouted at her, "Hey, you can't be in here." And she glided right through the wall.
Yep.
Out on the 41st Street.
Checks out.
It was well past 2 a.m. The guard was so shaken, he immediately called Dana Amendola, Disney Theatrical's vice president, at 2:30 in the morning. To this day, the security guard maintains that what he saw was the apparition of Olive Thomas. Since then, sightings have continued. Olive is often quiet, sometimes appearing only briefly, but she tends to show up when there is activity in the theater. A new show being loaded in, rehearsals underway, or sometimes when actors or crew members from her era or with similar energy are in the building. Some say she speaks more to men than women. Others claim she's simply watching quietly as the show goes on. Today, performers and crew entering the stage door on the 41st Street keep a tradition alive. They greet the ghost with a simple phrase, "Good morning, Olive." Her photo is framed backstage, a nod to her memory and gesture of goodwill to whatever presence might remain.
See, I love that. Mm-hmm. That's sweet. Good morning, Olive.
Again, it's like that whole respect thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
She's here. She's not hurting anybody. She's not nothing. But we're not going to ignore her.
She misses the drama. She mm-hmm. misses the theater.
Speaking of that, this next one, they, I wouldn't say taunt, because that's like aggressive. They try to pull the spirit out a little bit sometimes.
Okay.
But it's not in a very, like, it's not a taunting way. I didn't take it as a taunting way when I heard about it and read about it. So we're going to head on over to the Bolesco Theater at 111 West 44th Street, New York City.
Just a little side note, 111 is an angel number, which is interesting. I don't know what 111 is, but interesting enough.
Mm-hmm. So if you'd walked down Broadway in 1907, you would have found a brand new theater. The Stuyvesant opened that October by one of Broadway's most influential and eccentric figures, David Bolesco. So by 1910, Bolesco had renamed the theater after himself, and voila, the Bolesco Theater was born. Now, David Bolesco wasn't just a producer. He was a director, playwright, and visionary who transformed how Broadway looked, sounded, and felt. Between 1884 and 1930, he was involved in more than 100 productions. He was the first to adapt Madame Butterfly for the stage and helped launch the careers of Mary Pickford, Barbara Stanwyck, and James O'Neill. He also mentored Cecil B. DeMille, who brought Bolesco's stage innovations to Hollywood. Bolesco's theaters were different. He insisted on realism, even when it meant rewriting the rules of theatrical design. He introduced concealed lighting instead of footlights, experimented with colored gels to simulate sunsets, and pushed the state-of-the-art lighting boards to shape the mood and movement on stage. He even had a freight elevator installed to transport scenery from the basement to the stage an innovation that would become a standard in theater design.
That's crazy, actually. Mm-hmm.
Dude was just a straight...
He said, I know what I'm doing here. You can take after me.
Mm-hmm. But perhaps the most theatrical part of all was his personal residence. Located in a 10-room Gothic-style duplex above the theater, Bolesko lived there for years, surrounding himself with theatrical memorabilia, a private elevator, a grotto, and even a hidden collection of erotica.
A grotto. He was Ariel before Ariel was a...
Yeah.
Look at this stuff.
Also, Archie is ripping a toy apart, so if you hear the crinkling, it's a toy.
I'm not fighting with him. That's so mean. He's having such a good time.
He's having a grand old time. The decor resembled a church, which seemed fitting for a man nicknamed the Bishop of Broadway.
This is true.
That nickname wasn't just about his influence. Bolesko was known for wearing a long, dark cassock, resembling a Catholic priest's robe. Even though he was born Jewish and didn't formally practice any religion, his style only added to the mystique. Now, Bolesko died in 1931 at the age of 76. He'd been ill during the winter and seemingly recovered, but a slight heart attack occurred right before his death. Although the Schubert organization took ownership of the Bolesko in 1948, reports of Bolesko's presence continued. For a time, he was said to have been driven away by the controversial production of O Calcutta, a risque review that featured full nudity and seemed to offend his traditional sensibilities, even in the afterlife.
I could imagine that probably made him, like, turn over. He was like, what the heck?
What happened to my theater?
It's like, what is happening here?
But like any good character, Bolesko returned. Sighting of Bolesko's ghost often occurred during performances. The most common story of him, a shadowy figure in priest-like robes is seen sitting quietly in one of the private box seats, especially on open nights.
Everybody loves a good opening night.
Mm-hmm. Oh, who doesn't?
Opening and closing nights are the best to go mm-hmm. to a show.
Far from being menacing, his appearance is taken as a good omen, a sign that the production has his approval.
That is so true. If I thought that, like, the ghost of the theater that was haunting this theater came to see our performance, mm-hmm. I'd be like, okay.
We're good.
He liked it.
Yep. We're all good then. Some performers have claimed to have even shaken his hand, only to realize moments later that the man in the cassock wasn't on the call sheet. The ghost of David Bolesko is said to behave much like the man he did in life. Methodical, traditional, and something of a homebody. Staff have reported the sound of shuffling feet and faint jazz music coming from his old duplex apartment, even though it remains locked and undisturbed. When investigated, there's no signs of a break-in. Not even the dust appears to have been shifted.
You like jazz?
All right. Well, apparently he would always throw parties up there.
Yeah.
And now they say it's like disheveled and stuff now. It's just like wrecked. Yeah, they say it's just like wrecked. Completely destroyed up there now. But I would think that... Why would you not like... You could almost, if you want to, turn that into like an Airbnb.
Right.
Probably make millions just doing that.
Seriously.
One story, once quoted in the New York Times, tells of a dog that would growl an unseen presence every afternoon at precisely 4 p.m. Always the same spot, and always at nothing visible. So while David Bolesko's spirit may still linger in his namesake theater, he's not the only one. Many believe the Bolesko Theater is haunted by a woman known only as the Blue Lady. Thought to be one of Bolesko's former lovers, possibly a mistress, who fell to her death in the 1920s.
I feel like there's always got to be, like, some kind of, like, fall.
Yeah, somebody fell.
In a hotel or, like, a theater or something like this. I feel like we're always... Somebody fell from something.
Mm-hmm. The story goes that when she was leaving Bolesko's private duplex above the stage, she stepped into a faulty elevator, which plummeted down the shaft.
Oof, that's so scary.
No official record of her name exists, and the details remain vague, but her presence is something that the cast and crew still talk about. Eyewitnesses, including Broadway actors, stagehands, and even major stars, have described the ghost as a blonde woman in a flowing blue dress or in an icy blue mist that glides silently through the upper balcony. She's most often seen during final dress rehearsals or sitting in a locked box seats, watching performances unfold. Actress Laura Linney has even publicly shared her encounter, recalling the unmistakable sight of a blue lady seated quietly on the balcony during one of her shows. Tim Dolan, founder of Broadway Up Close Walking Tours, recounts how stagehands have witnessed the elevator rattling and moving on its own, nope, despite being long since disconnected.
Nope, 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 nope.
Now, I also read that, like, it's the chains that they see going and stuff, yeah, like that. Like, it's...
See, I hate that. That's so spooky.
Mm-hmm. And there's no reason those chains should be moving. So you're just like, what? In one instance, during a show, Enchanted April, in 2003, the elevator shaft made so much noise during a performance that the crew attempted to remove the lift, only discover it wasn't there anymore.
Nope.
Over time, the Blue Lady has become part of the Bolesco's backstage culture. Costumes designers sometimes include a blue dress in each production, said to honor her memory or her content. Her presence isn't threatening, just watchful.
I love that. Mm-hmm. The little blue dress. No, that's actually so cute.
That's like, it's, again, it's like, it's,
I
just
love it. The theater people are so respectful.
Yeah. It's just so cool. Like, the fact that they'll, like, you know, they'll buy into it, mm-hmm, too. All right, well, this show is
right.
Nothing to do with the blue dress, but we're going to hang a blue dress here for her.
Yeah.
She seems drawn to the theatrical energy, especially during moments of change or emotional weight. In a 2014 Playbill article, a film and television actress described being alone in her locked dressing room, showering before her performance. The door unlatched on its own, and when she looked out, the door was still securely locked, but the entire bathroom glowed with a faint blue hue. Some speculate that the elevator, now more ghost than machinery, serves as a passageway for her spirit, possibly even carrying her up to Bolesco's former apartment, which remains untouched.
I like that theory. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. So the next theater we're walking on down to...
Where are we going?
...is the New Victory Theater, located 209 West 42nd Street in New York. I feel like saying New York, everybody's going to be like, we get it. I get it.
We're not leaving New York, guys. We're still
here. Yeah, we're still in New York, so... While the Blue Lady is the most well-known female ghost associated with David Bolesco, she may not be the only one.
Hmm. He got around.
He did? I mean, he had a hand in over 100 productions.
All right.
So, over at the New Victory Theater, once briefly called Bolesco Theater during his ownership, the spirit of Miss Leslie Carter, Bolesco's famed leading lady, has also been reported. She was a celebrated actress known for her bold performances and scandalous divorce. Even after her death in 1937, theater staff say her energy has remained. Colleen Davis, production manager at New Victory, tells the story of a missing bow tie that reappeared just before curtain dropped from a mysteriously overturned storage bin with no one near it. The crew thanked Miss Carter and went on with the show.
Thanks, girl.
Uh-huh. So now we're going to head to Palace Theater. This one also located in New York at 1564 Broadway.
It's in New York?
Yeah.
No
way.
In
case you were wondering. Yep. The last couple of these are just kind of like small little guys. Nothing too crazy. We hit the I guess you would say, the big guns. When the Palace Theater opened in 1913... it quickly became the crown jewel of vaudeville. To play the Palace was a dream of every Vanderbilt. Everyone from Harry Houdini to Bob Hope to Judy Garland graced this stage. Even after the vaudeville faded, the Palace remained central to Broadway's heartbeat, hosting concerts and big-budget musicals.
Just name-dropping Judy Garland like that is just absolutely insane, but okay, proceed.
Mm-hmm. Oh, she's got her own thing.
Slay, Miss Judy.
But for all the marquee lights and the legendary talent, something else lingers in the rafters. One of the oldest ghost stories connected to the Palace involves Louis Bassolina, a trapeze artist who reportedly fell to his death mid-performance.
No.
Mm-hmm. Though official records are murky, his name survives through stories passed from usher to usher, crew to crew. With the records and stuff, some of the records say he survived,
mm-hmm,
but he was severely injured.
Mm.
So it was like a kind of weird, you know?
Murky kind of situation.
Yeah. I think he fell and just relives the fall.
Yeah.
Even after, like, after he died. Mm. They say he's still there, swinging midair, unseen, and heard screaming just above the proscenium arch. Some report sudden gusts of cold air sweeping across the upper mezzanine, accompanied by the metallic creak of phantom rigging.
Hmm.
According to Melissa Richel, a longtime palace staff member, several spaces in the theater have long been associated with unusual activity. One repeat offender is dressing room number 6. Those who enter often describe feeling chilled or even an inexplicable urge to leave. Some say it's like being watched or worse, being pushed out.
Hmm.
There are also 2 red chairs tucked away in a waiting area just outside the main auditorium. Sit down for a moment and you might suddenly feel compelled to stand up as though someone else is claiming the seat. So Melissa shares one particular vivid experience that left her a believer. It was just before a show. The theater was supposed to be empty. While making rounds, she looked up toward the balcony. She says, I saw a figure sitting in maybe the 3rd row back, she said. A man in a 3-piece suit, my first thought was. How did someone get in here already? I was about to walk over and ask him to leave, but as soon as I blinked, he was gone. She never saw him again, but she's convinced he wasn't just a trick of the light. Now, I will say when my contacts get all foggy like they do most times when we're trying to record these, I can see all kinds of things.
A whole person, though?
Maybe, if I let them get blurry enough.
I guess. Perhaps.
That's just me, though. The Palace Theater is undergoing renovations as of 2024, with plans to literally lift the entire building higher to make space for new commercial development beneath it. Some wonder whether this structural shift may awaken even more of its long-buried spirits. And while skeptics roll their eyes, others say the energy inside the palace is charged, layered, maybe even curious. Now we'll head on over to the Al Hirschkel Theater, still in New York. This is located at 302 West 45th Street. Originally opened as the Martin Black Theater, this Broadway house was renamed in 2003 to honor famed caricaturist Al Hirschfeld. But not everyone or everything may have approved of the name change. Ever since the renaming, strange happenings have been whispered backstage. Some say the original namesake, Martin Beck. Wow, I got that wrong earlier. The Beck Theater. There, thank you, Context. Martin Beck is not entirely pleased and has made his discontent known. During the original run of Into the Woods.
Love Into the Woods.
Actress, I've never seen it.
Really?
Hmm.
Oh, such a great show.
Well, actress Joanna Gleason reported a series of subtle but persistent disturbances in her dressing room. Every Sunday, after the matinee, Gleason would close all of the lids to her makeup, tidy up the space, and place everything in the center of her table. But when she returned for the next week's shows, she would often find them moved to the far end of the table. At first, it was easy to dismiss, maybe a draft, maybe someone bumped the vanity. But then something stranger happened. A single letter M appeared drawn on her mirror. She wiped it away. It came back again and again.
Nope. No. See, I would be like, I need a new dressing room. I'm never going in here ever again.
Yeah.
Throw out all the makeup, new vanity.
I want new everything. Unlike more mischievous hauntings, this ghost doesn't frighten or disrupt. It seems to be more of a cautious observer, perhaps still enamored with the glamour of Broadway life. A quiet fan who never left the stage doors behind. Even now, actors and crew occasionally mention small oddities. Makeup slightly out of place, vanity bulbs flickering when nobody's around, or the faint outline of a letter traced onto the glass. Maybe it's Martin Beck, still upset about the signage, or maybe it's M, still admiring the stars.
I'm not gonna lie, every time you keep saying M, I'm like, hello? Like, me? What are you talking about? Well,
see, you're E-M. This is just M.
This is just a letter.
So, I don't even know. Oh, no, this is a couple blocks away. Now we're heading a few blocks down to the Eugene O'Neill Theater, located 230 West 49th Street.
It is crazy, though, because in New York, like, in the Broadway district, the theaters are literally, like, right next to each other. Like, you walk 2 feet, yep, and there's another one.
Yeah. So the Eugene O'Neill Theater may be best known today for its high-energy comedy, The Book of Mormon. Oh, that play is so good.
It is.
So good. So dirty, but so good.
It was so good, though.
So funny. But its backstage stories lean more towards paranormal drama. During the 2006 run of Sweeney Todd...
Sweeney Todd is also that really good.
That is also a really good one. Cast members began to suspect that the theater had two paranormal residents, one male, one female. Actress Donna Lynn Chaplin, who shared the stage with Patty LaPlone, Michael Carreras, and Merwin Ford, recalled unnerving encounters. Dangerous props, like garden shears, would tumble off upstage shelves with no one nearby. Actors reported having their hair tugged or hearing their character's name whispered in their ears mid-performance. Mm-hmm. A mysterious scent of lilac would appear out of nowhere, especially downstage left.
Interesting.
Champlin's own whistle vanished from her pocket of her bloody lab coat, which never left the stage. Weeks later, it was found in the dead rack of costumes in the basement. It only reappeared because the rack was moved and it clattered to the floor. As for Patty, she had her share of run-ins too. Her dressing room would open and shut on their own. One time, she stepped backward and said, "Excuse me," thinking she bumped into a friend's foot. But when she turned, that friend was standing 2 feet away. Then there's Merwin Ford, who discovered just how polite the paranormal can be. One afternoon between rehearsal and show, he set up a cot to nap and jokingly asked the room out loud for a wake-up call. At exactly 6:30 p.m., he was jolted awake by a slap on the bottom of his shoe, so forceful that his head nearly hit the counter above him, and there was nobody else in the room. So now we have a few, we'll call them cameos, a few more cameos from some other theaters. We have the Lyric Theater, and on December 21st, 1909, during the opening night of Clyde Finch's The City, the playwright, who had died months earlier from blood poisoning, reportedly walked onto the stage after the final bows, took a graceful bow, and then vanished, leaving the audience and cast stunned. Several women screamed, and people fainted in horror. There were over 1,000 people in the audience who witnessed this. This sighting is considered one of Broadway's most well-documented ghost events and helped anchor the Lyric's supernatural reputation.
Yeah.
Right in front of 1,000 people?
What do you mean in front of 1,000 people? This man just walked on stage and took... He said, no.
Yeah.
This is my show. I'm taking my final bow. Absolutely not. Yep. Dang.
Then there's the Hudson Theater, Broadway's oldest still operating venue, opened in 1903, is rumored to be haunted by an early 1900s actress who reportedly ended her life in the mezzanine bathroom. Staff have reported unexplained cold spots, flickering lights, and whispered conversations with no visible source. Then there's also the Lyceum, is Broadway's oldest continuously operating theater, which opened in 1903, kind of just like the Hudson. Many believe this presence to be Bob Fosse, the legendary choreographer who favored watching performances from the same balcony during his life.
If any ghost was going to be in the presence of a performance, it would be Bob Fosse. And you want to know what? You better dance your ass off.
Mm-hmm.
One of the best choreographers ever.
Oh, yeah?
Yes. Of literally all time. Like, you've never heard of, like, Fosse dancing? Like, it's literally, like, a style. Oh,
yeah.
Like, yeah, that would be the man. That would be the man, the myth, the
Did
legend.
Did not know that.
Yep, that's him.
There are additional reports that describe footsteps in the catwalk, a shadowy figure in the wings, and a plaque in the back room corridor that persistently tilts forward despite being secured.
Hmm.
I have one more for you. This one's kind of more for M.
For me?
Yep. So, this one, like I said, just a last tidbit one. The Gershwin Theater.
Mm.
You know that one?
Go ahead.
It was opened in 1972 and is operated by the Nylander Organization and is named after brothers George and Ira Gershwin. They wrote several Broadway musicals. And The Gershwin Theater seats approximately 1,933 people across two levels. Let's jump into the ghosts. So, during the run of the witch-ridden musical, Wicked, actor Michael McCroy Rose wrote, according to sources in the known about these things, we have three ghosts. Drew, a.k.a. Dennis, is the only one we know by name. The other two ghosts regularly seen haven't been named, but one dresses in 19th century blue suit, and the other wears a white t-shirt. In 2010, Jason Viergo said stage manager Jason Dunter and assembled member Eddie Pendergraft were standing on stage left and happened to look up, thinking they saw a swinging performer watching the show. Then suddenly the person disappeared behind the curtain. The person they thought they saw was actually only a few feet away from them on stage. Then, in 2012, we have Jonathan Warren reporting Nathan Peck got tapped on the shoulder before his front of the house monkey fight one evening. When he turned around, no one was standing near him. Later, when he told people about it, Kevin Huckey mentioned that he had the same experience throughout the years in the same location. It is rumored and believed to be the ghost at the Gershwin. So yeah. For all you Wicked fans out there.
As soon as you said the Gershwin, I was like, that's the Wicked Theater. I said, wait a damn minute.
Yep.
I know that place.
Yep.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So as the final spotlight fades and the velvet curtains fall, we leave behind haunted corridors, creaking catwalks, and whisper memories of Broadway's ghostly legends, from the ever-watchful Olive Thomas at the New Amsterdam Theater, to the blue mist trailing through the Bolesco, and the playful pranks at the New Victory. These stories remind us that the theater is never truly empty. Whether born from superstition, tragedy, or fierce love for the stage, these spirits seem to linger, not as threats, but as echoes. Echoes of performers who never left the wings of characters who refused their final cue, of stories too powerful to fade completely into the dark. So the next time you're seated in a dim theater, waiting for the lights to rise, take a moment, glance at the balcony, listen closely during scene changes. That cold spot, that flickering light, it might just be someone making their entrance. So that pulls everything into a tie.
That was fun. I liked right? that.
I thought it was a good one to start.
Kind of episode.
Thought it was a good way to start ghosty season.
Ghostly season. It is ghostly season.
Spooky
anyway.
Season.
Spooky yeah. season. Ghostly season.
Thought it was
season.
Fun. A lot of people go to Broadway and.
Heck yeah.
Why you not tie
what,
some ghosts to it?
You know what's funny?
It?
This is actually making me want to go see a Broadway show. It's
yeah,
been
I know.
A while. I'm like
we're
itching
due.
For it.
Yeah, we're due to go see.
Was the last one you saw The Lion King?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was also the last one I saw.
Yeah.
It's been too long.
Which is, what a play.
Oh my god, it was insane.
So, with all that being said, I forgot to do it earlier, but please rate, give us 5 stars, as many stars as you would like. But
yeah, as many as you want.
Helps us reach out, helps us get out there further. We do have a whole kind of theme for spooky season. I would just say we were trying to pick some of our more... We started kind of lightly spooky, and then we're going to end with a, I guess we would call it a bang,
yeah.
because we will be recording that episode on location,
yeah.
and we have, at least, I have 2 personal experiences from there, and by the time we record it, Em may have her own.
I'm excited.
So, don't forget to keep checking back.
Yeah, make sure you're staying tuned this month.
We would like to thank Sam.
Yes.
For all her hard work she does for the show. Go listen to her at Scare Me Sam. Or check her blog out at ScareMeSam.com. I'm sure you guys are sick of hearing it, but we have socials. The Ominous Archives. If you have your own story you want to share with us, TheOminousArchives@gmail.com. Send it on over. We try to get back as quick as we can. I think that pretty much wraps us up. So, as always, don't forget to come back next week as we dive into more strange and haunted stories in the Ominous Archives. See ya.
See ya.